Senate Finance Committee to order for February the 12th. Today we're going to be going through the SB 16, the Oil Discharge Prevention and Non-Tank Vessel Bill, as well as Municipal School Bond Reimbursement Bill, which is SB 2, and if I hope we have time for all this, SB 52, which is the termination of the State Physical Therapy Board, and as well 53, which is the barbers and hairdressers. Present at the table are Senator Wilson, Senator Lehman, Co-Chair Donnelly, myself, Senator Kelly, Senator Green, Senator Osterman, and Senator Hoffman. Senator Olson apparently is at a funeral service and is excused, as well as Senator Ward, who is excused as well. If there are any witnesses, be sure and sign up for any testimony that we have for these bills. And at this time, I guess we can go on to SB 16. Is Larry Dietrich here? I don't see him. Oh, there you are, Larry. Yeah. Do you want to come up and maybe answer some of the questions that we had? As you recall, last time there were some questions on these on this bill, and the different offices were going to get with the DEC as well as the sponsor to resolve any questions that might be hanging out there. Senator Donnelly, I believe you had some that you formally submitted to them.
Yep.
And were those added to your satisfaction?
No.
Would you like to follow up this time?
Sure. I don't think the members have this in their packets. They should, though. It's the response to the questions that we make. First of all, we asked them to clarify the funding source on the, it just refers to 1052 on the fiscal note. So they submitted, they gave me this list of the codes used for the Alaska budgeting system, and 1052 is one of about 12 or 15 codes that stands for response fund. So, Mr. Chairman, when we do get to the question of the fiscal notes, I think we should amend it so it's in English so that an ordinary person could understand what it means when they read it. It says some obscure code. So that's my first concern.
Sir, Donnelly, I was just to say that pretty much the meat of the bill, I think we had all our questions answered on, and we were stuck on the fiscal note.
Yeah.
So that's what the discussion will be about today, would be the fiscal note.
Well, on that one fiscal note, I'd go ahead and amend it to replace the 1052, or to add to 1052 the words response fund.
Senator Donnelly, I think people are having a hard time hearing you there. Could you repeat that?
I'd move to amend to add the words response fund, or to, actually it should be more specific, it should be oil spill response fund, to the fiscal note where it currently reads simply 1052. And by the way, I'm drafting a memorandum to all agencies that fiscal notes should, as much as possible, be in English and not some code where they don't provide the code so that somebody could go and see what it meant. My second question was that why did the task force recommend against users' fees? And they really didn't answer the question. They just said the task force discussed users' fees and recommended something different. So they didn't ever answer that question at all. My third question was, why did the response fund, was it selected as the funding source? And it just said recommendation 31 said that it should be the response fund. In view of efforts to limit general fund expenditures, the department assumed that that would be a preferred source rather than user's fees, I assume. But they didn't explain why user's fees weren't appropriate for this. Then we asked, is the proposed program eligible for the response fund? They said yes. I was hoping there'd be a little more identification and explanation of the different sections of the response fund there. And what are the impacts for using the response fund?
Maybe we could just start with the first question. And Mr. Dietrich, Senator Donnelly, what was of that list? I think that
the first one was
on the 1052 coding, which I think that's pretty self-explanatory. The second one you had was,
why did they recommend against users' fees?
And there was some discussion about that, I think, maybe in a previous committee. But it was the general consensus of the people that were working on the task force that industry was simply didn't see the fairness in having this thrust on them, and then having to have them pay for it when we do have the response fund, which by the statutes is a very appropriate use of the response fund. I think that was the general discussion that came out of the task force. Mr. Dietrich, I don't know if you're here to speak about recommendations that came out of the task force or just the fiscal note, but is that a fair characterization that you remember from the task force?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich. I'm the Director of Spill Prevention and Response. And Mr. Chairman, yes, I think that is a fair characterization of the task force discussion. And Brian Rogers should be on teleconference from Fairbanks, and he was the task force facilitator and may be able to expand beyond that if you desire.
Brian, hi, this is Senator Kelly. Did you hear the question, and would you like to comment on whether that was a fair characterization or not?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Brian Rogers from Information Insights, the facilitator of the Task Force on Motorized Oil Transport. And I think the issue was that the users in this case are businesses that are going to need to be paying for the cost of protection in terms of acquiring response equipment, booms, deployments, skimmers, et cetera, and since they were already going to be facing some cost in dealing with the effects of the legislation you passed last year, and because the oil spill response fund appeared to the task force to include in its uses the prevention of oil spills, that it was an appropriate use of that fund.
Senator Donnelly?
Brian, are any of the people who would be required to do actions under this new legislation, are any of them paying into the response fund?
None of the people who are required to do actions, Mr. Chair, are required to. There was one, there were representatives of two or three companies that do pay into the fund. Maybe two who are members of the committee, including DP Exploration Alaska, Thorough Alaska.
Well, my concern, Mr. Chairman, is that these folks aren't paying into the response fund, so it's really easy for them to recommend that we take the money from the response fund for this, since they're not paying into the response fund. I think it's real easy to come up with schemes where somebody else pays for your business or your activities, you know, and I got a real concern with that. I mean, it just doesn't seem appropriate.
Senator Donnelly, I guess I look at it a different way, in that when we asked last week if there was a, you know, this federal statute or something hanging over our heads out there that was forcing the state into these sets of regulations, and the answer was no. And if I'm a business person out there, well, look, there doesn't seem to be any big, huge call for this, and all of a sudden I've got to pay for the regulations myself. I can see how the task force would gravitate towards that fund. We did talk about the impact on the fund, or I believe one of Senator Donnelly's questions was the impact on the fund, and of the answers that came back on those sheets, I think that was the one I was probably most displeased with, because the impact on the fund, obviously, particularly in a light of declining production, any withdrawal from the fund over a period of time while the production levels decrease and that the dollars going into the fund decreases is that the fund ultimately will be used up, not necessarily completely by this, but it does deplete the funds. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes.
I think the answer that, I guess the only reason I bring it up is that the answer that you gave on the sheet really didn't address that, and that it does, in fact, deplete the fund.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and we have looked at that, the out years. We looked at the out years on the fiscal note for the long-term cost to do some a long-term assessment of the effects of the two positions in the out years on the long-term health of the fund. And when you looked at, we used the Department of Revenue forecasts as the official state forecast as the revenue that would be generated by the 3-cent surcharge based on their production forecast. And those are the official estimates that we go by when we're doing the budget planning. When you look at the out years, basically the 3% roughly brings in the order of $9 to $10 million for the out years here. And Ledge Finance recently did an analysis of this that we jointly reviewed with them. So roughly at $9 to $10 million in the out years, as the continued level of revenue that would be produced by the current production forecast, the $141,000 fiscal note, which is the long-term permanent cost, then is about 1 to 2% then of the 3 cent surcharge revenue, which we feel is sustainable, considering that this is the size of this group and the extent to which we've gone to scale back the fiscal note to make it a streamlined process.
So it isn't just sucking it dry or anything like that. Senator Donnelly?
Have you done any analysis of what a fees-based system would look like?
Through the chair, Senator Donnelly, the task force did look into some fee-based systems from an incentive standpoint to determine if there were some ways to provide an incentive for participation based on economic aspects. And for the most part, they kind of turned those down in the end in favor of the recommendation 31, which ultimately they felt that amongst the various tools that were available, and we did discuss tax incentives as another way, that was the best one, and that's where they ended up concluding was the best direction to go.
You said a fee system as an incentive. You mean like, I don't really see fees as an incentive. I don't understand what your point was there. You mean as a fine? You got a fee if you didn't do it, or what?
Yes, Senator Dowling, through the chair, one part of the task force report in the package was to come up with incentives for encouraging the industry to pursue prevention measures. In almost all cases anymore, there's always a lot of effort gone into trying to encourage industry to prevent the spills, because in the long run, that's probably the better and the cheaper way to go. So a number of incentive systems were looked at as ways for the industry to accomplish prevention measures as part of this effort. And tax incentives were one of the things that were looked at as a way to encourage the industry to pursue prevention measures under this legislation.
Let's go back to my original question now.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any analysis of the fees-based system to pay for this? Talked about an incentive called fees, but those are really some sort of tax breaks.
Sure.
Talking about a fees-based system, was there any analysis of a fees-based system to pay for this?
Yes, Senator Donnelly, through the chair. The analysis, the things that the task force relied upon beyond the tax incentives that were discussed for the prevention system was to use the private sector to the maximum extent possible to implement the legislation. And the things that the package is dependent on is the use of existing spill response co-ops, the use of existing stevedoring operations, ship agents, and there's a new marine exchange coming online. Those were felt by the committee to be the best way to go to hold costs down. Now, was there a specific financial cost of that, or cost benefit done on that? The answer is no, and that was because they felt that there's a chicken and an egg thing here. The co-ops, before they can lock in on certain fees or rates, have to know the pool of vessels in it are going to participate. And they felt that would be worked out over due time. Brian may be able to help out on this a little bit, too. He was a key part of these discussions.
Mr. Rogers, do you want to jump in? Oh, excuse me, Senator Donnelly.
So my question was there analysis of a fees-based system? And that answer, what I can pull from it, is that they were reluctant to do an assessment of fees because they didn't know what vessels and vehicles would be subject to this yet, so they didn't do a fees-based analysis.
Senator Donnelly, through the chair, that's correct. The detailed fee analysis was not done. The total pool of vessels is approximately 900, so we have a pretty good handle on the total number of vessels. But the percentage of those vessels that want to share in a single response capability, say in one co-op, the extent to which they will share in a single co-op and thereby reduce the cost is something that won't be worked out until they actually engage in those negotiations with the co-ops. And in other words, if one vessel were to meet all the requirements, that single vessel operator would have to bear the full cost of meeting that compliance. On the other hand, if 500 vessels bear in that single response capability, then the cost of that capability is shared amongst 500 vessels. And knowing those arrangements and whether or not vessel groups will want to build their own capability because they already have the starter resources, which in some cases they do, whether they will all join the same co-op, whether they will form a new co-op, or whether they will pursue other business arrangements with other partners doing business in their area is something that the legislation depends on, but it's also something for which they weren't able to work out exactly what the preferences would be ahead of time.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm starting to understand what the answer to number five should have been, which would be a more clear explanation that there's a difficulty in assessing fees because of the complexity of the systems that are being involved here, but that isn't what the response we got here. I think that would have been real helpful, although I think you could cut through this and say what you're saying about one-tenth of what you've done here.
Mr. Chairman, I'm
Mr.
Paul Foose.
I'm
Paul Foose. I served as a Marine Technical Advisor to the committee. Senator Donnelly, the answer to your question is no. We did not look at what the fees would be if you charged in addition to the fees of complying with it and paying the co-ops and getting your certificate of financial responsibility and all of those. And when we looked at it, the response fund, the 3-cent fund, was designed for purposes such as this. And the historical compromise that was reached years ago, where the 2 cents would lead up to $50 million and would then end, the industry pretty much said, okay, we know we're going to have that 3 cents forever. That was the historical deal that was cut. And they don't really mind it if it's used for things that actually are prevention and response, which this is. What really drives them wild is when money gets spent for things that are completely off the map for what the fund was intended for. And as was stated, there were a couple oil company representatives on there, and they didn't raise an objection to this.
Mr. Chairman, part of the industry's thoughts or thinking behind this is, as the payer of the 3 cents, is to the extent there are additional vessels now participating in the safety net and participating in the same co-ops that they've either created or used, that they're, in the future there's a potential decrease in their costs as well.
That's correct.
Mr. Donald, is there any cap? Is this just an estimate of what's going to be assessed against the 3-cent fund, or is there some way, you know, if we develop a system with a virtually unlimited revenue source, what's our guarantee that it's that the costs are going to be restrained?
Mr. Chair, through the Chair, Senator Donnelly, your guarantee is the Senate Finance and House Finance Committee. You write the budget every year.
Senator Donnelly, I could augment. I mean, some of the things that we've looked at to try to put, because of the concern for controls and not expanding down the road and stuff, is one of the reasons we changed the, during the peak period here when the plans come in and the reviews and the program is implemented, we changed two of the permanent positions to temporaries. So that for those peak years, if you look at the note for Aught 3 and Aught 4, that was done in response to the concerns for, you know, once it's a permanent position, it's on the books, it gets carried on. So two of those were switched back to temporary to accommodate the peak load, and then they're throttled back in Aught 5 to just the two. And so we intentionally installed those as temporary to capture the peak load with the idea that would be another way of getting to your concern of trying to ratchet it back then to what a long-term number of permanent positions would be.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. Any other questions? Senator Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, you know, and maybe the others don't, that we sent over some questions this morning that you may have just received before you came over. Have you had a chance to look at those? Could you respond to those today, or would you rather have a little more time? I'll just say I apologize for us not getting them to you sooner, but some of them are right in line with some of the questions that have been asked already. Do you want to jump into them?
Through the chair, Senator Lehman, yes, I think we could, and that's in view of the fact we've already had some interactions going on this with you over the course of the past week, so a number of these are related, so I think we can attempt to do them today.
Senator Lehman, does the committee have a copy of your question?
I don't know. I mean, you have?
If we can get a copy of those questions. Are you just going to go through them one by one?
Yeah, two.
That's all right.
The first two are right in line with
okay.
With some of the questions. No.
I'm not sure we need a copy of it, but go ahead, Senator Lehman.
How does the production level decrease from last fall's estimate of a million barrels a day affect your estimates of the balance? First question. Have you taken that into account?
Yes, Senator Lehman, through the chair. The document, I don't know if the committee has it, the productions estimates that we use are from the Department of Revenue Tax Division. It's called the Fall 2000 Revenue Sources Book. This is the document that the agencies use for planning their fiscal budgets. The budget planning for the response fund is done on an annual fiscal year basis. And it's essentially what we do is at the end of the fiscal year, you look at the checkbook, see what the balance is. We add to it then the projected revenues over the next fiscal year. So for this year's plan would be for FY02. We subtract from it then the expenditures that are planned for that year in the budget, and then that determines the balance at the end of the '02 fiscal year. Now, what happens during that year, to get to your question, is the actual production does fluctuate from the number that we select to prepare the budget, which when the budget actually starts going together by the state, we actually use the spring forecast number. Then it's updated in fall. So, yes, it does fluctuate. I think we have the advantage in that the fluctuations in the production aren't anywhere near as wild or as difficult to predict as the price per barrel fluctuations. So, yes, it does fluctuate, but in the end, we've been operating under this now for quite some time, and even over the course of the year, even though you get some fluctuations as suggested here, it usually balances out by the end of the fiscal year, and based on what we know from what revenue has provided, we don't think there'll be any substantial negative impacts this year on the flow.
Or even in the near out years.
That's right, and the farther you get out into FY04 and FY05, certainly the more speculative it becomes. I know BP has just recently announced that they actually want to go for an increase as their goal and target now by FY05, which is real good. That kind of information is not reflected yet in the revenue forecast, but certainly an upside potential target that the companies hit is good and actually enhance the fund and drive it the other way.
The next question, do you concur with our fiscal analyst's estimate or analysis of the amount available for appropriation of $27.7 million?
Senator Lehman, through the chair, yes, we did work with Ledge Finance on some forecasts that they prepared, and they did, the staffs from both our department, the accountants and whatnot, did work with Ledge Finance, and that is a correct starting number that they use for their '02 forecast.
And the fourth question, are these response monies that RSAW departments included in the operating budget total of nearly $23 million?
Senator Lehman, yes, they are.
The next is you have 20 staff, at least by our analysis, currently reviewing 140 contingency plans. Are all of these in one division? If you could please explain, if that's correct, your rationale for the additional positions. Is there existing workload such that you need more people? Can you accommodate them with the existing workload?
Senator Lehman, through the chair, yes, we did look at that. All of these positions, they are in the Spill Prevention Response Division. So the answer to that question is yes. By comparison, the staff now currently review for the crude non-crude industry approximately 140 plans. The number of vessels that will be brought in by SB 273 or SB 16, if it's implemented, is approximately 900 vessels and 500 plans. We're only planning on two people to do that in the long run, and that's because we're relying heavily on the assumptions that the streamlined plans and that the existing marine infrastructure will carry the load.
The next question is somewhat speculative. It's sort of trying to project what you might do in the future, but are you fairly confident in these projections that the department's not going to be coming back in the future and saying, oh, you know, we're going to need even more to do these, to fund this. Is that the sixth question?
Yes. Senator Lehman, through the chair. Yes, indeed, that's what we've been driven towards in trying to prepare the fiscal note. We understand the concerns for the long-term fiscal situation, and that's why we have gone to temporaries and tried to throttle this back. It's in response to everyone's concern that we not come back in the future years.
And seventh question is, how many of your staff are currently working on not only reviewing, but testing and training contingency plans?
Senator Layman, through the chair, we've estimated just for the contingency plan function, there's probably about 20 right now that are currently managing the plans for the existing crude oil and non-crude oil industry in Alaska.
And all of those are working in testing and as well?
That's correct.
Okay. Are these plans updated every 3 years?
Senator Layman, that's correct.
And you've been, as a department, doing contingency plans for how long?
Senator Layman, through the chair, yeah, too long. It started actually in the 80s that we actually had legislation on the books prior to the 1989 event that required contingency plans. The department was engaged prior to that. They took a significant new direction then in the passage of HB 567 following the 89 event.
Since House Bill 567 passed, have you worked on templates or different models for streamlining the review of these plans?
Senator Layman, through the chair, yes, we spent a lot of time working with industry on how to do that, and we now have plans in place. What we're trending towards here is what we call umbrella plans, for example, for spot charter industry. In Cook Inlet, we will have one operator that will prepare the plan and have the plan, and then as they bring in new spot charters that will be bringing oil in, or perhaps in some cases exporting oil, we can add those vessels to that C plan on a very short notice, as short as 5 days. We're doing the same thing on the North Slope to standardize the whole approach for contingency planning on the North Slope so that we have one set of scenarios that covers the entire gamut of North Slope operations for the different kinds of facilities. So there's a number of efforts that we work with, not just industry, but then also with Minerals Management Service and the Coast Guard on the planning aspects.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That completes my series of questions. Thanks for accommodating several.
Now, we were going to amend the system, but I don't think we ever actually moved that, did we?
We have an annual.
Oh, yes, just a moment. We'll have a brief at ease, please.
One little quick thing. Is there anybody from DOT here or Marine Highway? Could you just submit a new fiscal note that had the sponsor and the requester legislation accurate on it for us? Could you?
Mr. Foose, could you give your seat up to Mr. Kavanji?
I just wondered if by tomorrow you could submit a new fiscal note that accurately reflected the sponsor and the requester of the legislation.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Certainly will.
Senator
Donnelly,
I think
that's
the right answer.
That's right.
Oh, there's a new one here.
You've got to do
that
one.
That wasn't in my file.
Yeah, it wasn't. Senator Donnelly didn't have it in
his file, so that'll take care of it.
Okay, thank you. Were there any other questions from the committee? Tomorrow we're going to, tomorrow we'll come back and address Senate Bill 16. I just want to make sure all the questions the committee has on any of the meat of the bill or any of the fiscal notes are addressed today, and then tomorrow we're going to come back, and I think Senator Layman or Senator Donnelly are going to have some recommendations on the fiscal note, and then we'll move it out at that time. So unless there are any other questions, we're going to hold this. Senator Wilkerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so I understand, are you fellows going to follow up on the user fee concept just to get a sense of what you're talking about?
Senator Layman?
Yes, Chairman. I thought that we were going to let Senator Wilkin take a lead on that particular point.
Okay, $850.
It's kind of like Senator Terrio with the number of that. I guess Senator Layman and Donnelly will have, if you want to huddle with them afterwards on the specifics of what they're going to do.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions on SB 16, let's go ahead and move to the next bill then.
The only thing I would
say,
as long as we've got a day, do you think somebody who wants this bill could do a sponsor statement for it? There's no sponsor statement provided to the committee yet for the bill. And I think that'd be real helpful. That's just normal procedure. We usually don't even have a hearing if we don't have one of those.
Senator Donnelly, I think you're right. I agree with you. I think probably the members of the task force thought that the report that they issued maybe would suffice for a sponsor today's statement, but it's certainly nice to have everything encapsulated into a few paragraphs. And if you could have that before the meeting tomorrow, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Good
brief at ease just for a moment. I'm going to roll SB2 to the bottom of the calendar. We'll hear that one and probably hold it over for a while. And at this time, if we could go to SB 52 and then follow up with SB 53, which seemed like fairly straightforward bills that the committee could get through rather quickly. I'd like to move those out today if possible. Heather, I see you running away as table. Senator Hoffman?
What about the other one, SB 21?
SB 21, as I said at the beginning, we had Senator Olson's not here today, so we're going to hold that for tomorrow. Ms. Briggs, could you state your name? You're from Senator Terrio's office, correct?
For the record, my name is Heather Briggs, staff to Senator Terrio, chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, which is the sponsor of Senate Bill 32, an act extending the termination date of the State Board of Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy. This bill would amend Title 8, Chapter 3, Section 10 to extend this particular board an additional 6 years to from June 30th, 2001 to June 30th, 2007. In your packets, you'll find a sponsor statement, letters of support, the current version of Senate Bill 52, a draft zero fiscal note, and a legislative audit, which was released on December 6, 2000. The audit was performed under Title 4466, Legislative Oversight. And the audit found that the board is operating in an efficient and effective manner and should continue to regulate physical and occupational therapists. Legislative audit believes the board is safeguarding the public interest by promoting the competence and integrity of those who hold themselves out as such. It continues to serve a public purpose and has demonstrated an ability to conduct its business in a satisfactory manner. It continues to propose changes to regulations, improve the effectiveness of the board, and ensure that the occupations it oversees are licensed in the state of Alaska. The legislative audit also recommended that this board be continued to 2007. And Pat Davidson from Legislative Audit is here, along with Kathy Reardon from the Department of Community and Economic Development.
Thank you, Ms. Briggs. Senator Donnelly, are you interested in doing a conceptual amendment, possibly on the date?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we typically have statutory guidelines 4 years. There is an exception. We can do longer if we want, but I'd recommend that we stick with the 4 years. So I'd move at this time that the line 6 of the legislation, reach 2007, be changed to 2005.
Are there objections? The amendment is adopted. Further comments on the bill? What is the will of the committee? Senator Lehman?
Chairman, I'm going to move to report committee substitute for Senate Bill 52 from committee with the accompanying zero fiscal
and fiscal amendment.
And, yeah, well, it's a committee substitute. Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Briggs. Next, SB 53. See how fast that went? I bet you we could do the exact same thing.
Oh,
not so, huh? Okay. Ms. Briggs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, my name is Heather Briggs, staff of Senator Terrio, who's chairman of Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, which is the sponsor of Senate Bill 53, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. The bill amends Title 8, Chapter 3, Section 10 to extend this board an additional 4 years from June 30th, 2001 to June 30th, 2005. Again, in your packet, sponsor statement, letter of support from the current board chairman, Cheryl Sutton, current version of the bill, a draft zero fiscal note, and a legislative audit also released on December 6, 2000, performed under Title 4466, Legislative Oversight. And the legislative audit found that the board should be reestablished. It is a benefit to the public's health, safety, and welfare. The board benefits the public by establishing minimum educational and experience requirements that provide reasonable assurance that persons licensed are qualified. And the Legislative Audit Division recommended the board be extended to June 30th, 2005.
Thank you, Ms. Briggs. Senator Green, excuse me.
I just remembered that I have a packet in my office of an inquiry about this very thing from a constituent. Could we pull this till tomorrow? And let me get those questions together.
Could I ask you a question first?
Senator Donnelly, let's go ahead and go through the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to point out this bill is one sentence long, doesn't propose to add any new employees, yet it has an excellent sponsor statement. So thank you very much for the sponsor. my question is really for the auditors on it. Was there any inquiry into the concept of self-testing on behalf of the educators of barbers and hairdressers? That was an issue that came up several years ago. As a way to improve the efficiency and to make sure that the testing was offered on a more convenient basis to people who are wishing to go into these professions.
Through the chair, Senator Donnelly, what we looked at was how many times the tests were being offered. Statute, I believe, calls for twice a year, and we saw that the testing was being done more often than that. I believe it was 4 to 6 times in Anchorage, about 3 times in Juneau and Fairbanks. So there seemed to be an adequate dispersion of it. And because of that, we didn't go into that area any further.
Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, several years ago I had constituent contacts, which is Senator Green, I think, said recently too, saying that in some other states they do it in a more efficient way with the schools themselves do the testing and the certification, and that way, if somebody misses just one portion of the test, they don't have to wait 3 months or till the next state opportunity to actually be able to go out in the marketplace to do that. That's something that I'm interested in to make this process more efficient. But you know, I guess I need to know the pros and cons more.
Through the chair, Senator Donnelly, as I said, because when we looked at it, there did seem to be a sufficient minimum number of tests being offered. We didn't really go into expanding it in a greater detail. Off the top of my head, if you're looking for the school that educated the student to be the sole determinant of whether or not they are qualified, you might look at sort of a conflict of interest there. I know that there's always some discussion if there's a board member who runs a school, how should they be evaluating their students? There's always those type of issues out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Donnelly. I'm going to go ahead and there were some questions I think that Senator Green had. Senator Green, are the questions that you have?
they're actually having to do with standards for cosmetologists, aestheticians, and nail and skin care.
I guess I'd like to go ahead and see if we can't move this bill then, because I think both Senator Donnelly and Senator Green were talking about things that are probably beyond the scope of just an extension bill.
Mr. Chairman. You know, that's part of the sunset review. And the way I look at the sunset review is looking for ways to, well, first of all, if something still continues to have a need or a value to the state, and this certainly does. I mean, we, much as we sometimes make light of this particular board, it's very important that these people be very qualified and skilled in their jobs. But the other function of Sunset is to possibly improve the existing system. And although I'm not suggesting I spend a lot of time on this, I am curious in this question that has been raised in the past. And I was kind of hopeful that the audit would have examined that. And since it didn't, it'd be helpful to me just to have a day to explore some of these ideas with the legislative auditors. And I'll probably come back tomorrow and say, well, I've looked at it. I really don't need to propose any changes, but I'd like the opportunity to do that.
Fair enough.
I just have one more question. I was kind of curious, after the legislation that was passed last year concerning the inclusion of body piercing and tattoos, how many applicants have turned in licenses and requests for membership in this sort?
Catherine, would you like to come
forward? For the record, Catherine Reardon, Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Community and Economic Development, and my staff, Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. No licenses have been issued for body piercing or tattooing and permanent cosmetic coloring at this point. The board, meeting the first week of January, decided what it was going to public notice for comprehensive regulations about these professions. We are waiting probably for another month in order to issue the board's public notice at the same time that DEC issues its public notice about the sanitary conditions of these shops so that the industry can see the whole picture at once when it gets the public notice. The requirement that you have a license in order to practice this profession doesn't go into effect, I believe, until July 1, 2002. The transitional license, the grandfather license deadline for application for that grandfathered license is June 30th or July 1, 2001. So we're still in the very beginning stages of the licensing and regulation of this these two professions.
Mr. Reardon? Agree? Do you have another question?
No.
Okay, we'll go ahead and hold it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You bet. Mr. Jackson, I'd like to come up and present SB 2, the Municipal Bond Reimbursement Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I am staff to Senator Torgerson, who is the prime sponsor of Senate Bill 2. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is pretty straightforward. This is a fix to last year's House Bill 281. There was language in that bill that has presented and posed a problem for the Anchorage School District in particular in terms of sales of the bond for school construction. This fixes that language. I have in your packet an article from the Daily News that kind of describes the dilemma, and then there was support from the Anchorage School District and also from the Northwest Arctic Borough School District for the language revision. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Any questions from the committee? I'm going to hold this bill as well for a short period of time, and we'll take it up at a later date.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Any other business to come before the committee? With that, we are adjourned.